Welcome back to another episode of Travel with a Chance of Murder. We are off to Europe this week. So we are leaving New Jersey in our rearview mirror, and we are heading off to Bulgaria this week, which is something that we did quite recently. A month ago, we went and explored Bulgaria, so it's extra special for us to now get to reflect on our time there and dive into the spooky and the fun and the history and recap it all for you guys.
Yeah, I think many people don't instantly think of, oh, let's go to Bulgaria for a holiday, but I think we're both really glad that we did. The only real reason we went was because the flights were cheap, and 100% I will be definitely going back because I feel I didn't cover it all. So as Cassie said, let's just jump into it and see what we're really dealing with, and hopefully we can entice you and go into Bulgaria as well.
Yeah, I mean, that could be our first tip before we even get anywhere is budget airlines. They are your friend.
So, Bulgaria, a discovery to share. Bulgaria, officially the Republic of Bulgaria, is nearly rectangular in outline. It's bounded by Romania to the north, with most of the border marked by the lower Danube River. And then you get the Black Sea to the east, Turkey and Greece to the south, Macedonia to the southwest, and Serbia to the west. So it's on that little crossroad area between the Middle East, Central Northern Europe, Asia, and the Mediterranean Basin. Now, because of this, the area of Bulgaria has been inhabited for eons and has always been sought after by many civilizations because of its crossroads and because of its lucrative trade value. It's always been the link between Northeast Europe to the Mediterranean and then West Central Europe to the Middle East. Before the official state of Bulgaria was created, you had these many empires of, you know, Rome, Greece, and the Byzantiums. They are all had a strong presence in the area because of the trade, and thus there's an influence on now Bulgaria because of the frequency of the trade and the passing of people moving around.
I think that's funny too that the location is so important and makes it so valuable, because I definitely couldn't have pointed to where it was on the map before we got there.
Yeah, that's the thing about it. It's why I find so fascinating researching Bulgaria and going to Bulgaria. Many people assume it's just a small little forgotten area, but it is literally the crossroads of so many of these big empires. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about it.
Great.
So the story of modern Bulgaria begins when Slavic people invaded the Balkan Peninsula in the 6th and 7th centuries. And this was a time whenever the Byzantium Empire was occupied by war with Persia to the east. And because of this, they weren't able to fortify the borders to the north, which allowed for Slavic tribes and peoples to come in from the north. So over the next few hundred years, the Empire of Bulgaria gained lots of new territory to the north, to the west, to the south, but most of this territory was old Byzantine territory, if you will, and these here people were linked to Christianity. So there's lots of these here Slavic people, the Bulgars, the Byzantine people, lots of different cultures and beliefs mixing together, but because of the new territory was so ingrained with Christianity, in 870, the entire Bulgarian Empire adopted Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, under Boris I. Now, the interesting part is the new church of Bulgaria, it adopted both Slavic and Bulgar elements, which helped create the bond between the, quote, original peoples, the Slavs, and the, quote, new people, the Bulgars. And then over the next few hundred years, so and then in the 11th century, it's really hard to differentiate between the Bulgars and the Slavics that became so ingrained with themselves. Now, the height of the Bulgarian Empire, its peak, its power, its prestige, and its culture occurred during the reign of Simeon the First, or Simeon the Great. Now, he ruled from 893 to 927. And he conquered many lands, and he beautified his capital, which is now Veliki Preslav. I may be pronouncing that incorrect. And the old capital is in East Bulgaria. The new capital is Sofia.
That's so crazy. It's the time of the three-digit year. The 800s.
Yeah, it's a long, long time ago. So what I found quite interesting was this is where the Cyrillic alphabet was born. Mm. Lots of history into how it was adopted and created. This is what I find quite interesting. Like
it dates all the way back to the 800s. Well, I mean, we did not see hardly any English there. So it makes sense that they started the alphabet that long ago and kind of continued through to this day, because it's definitely thriving.
Yeah.
Everyone speaks it. It's everywhere. The road signs. There's really not very much English.
That is something I feel that we struggle with a little bit. You know, being as English speakers, we rudely assume that everywhere's going to speak English. And we have been in some places that it's been difficult, but it was particularly difficult in Bulgaria.
I would almost say more so than Israel. It was maybe right in line with...
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, you know, I don't know, Hebrew and Cyrillic, obviously they're different language, different writing styles and stuff like that, but you can't even guess what some of the words mean. Like, we had... we're trying to park our car at some stages, and we had no idea if we were allowed to, because...
They look like math equations. They look like pi signs and stuff.
Yeah, the Cyrillic alphabet is just math. if you're going to Bulgaria, make sure you know some of the language. We didn't. We just brought translators with us.
Yeah, or make sure you have Google Maps downloaded and ready to go.
Yeah. So, let's get back into the history. Unfortunately, after Simeon's death in 937, there was lots of internal divisions that weakened the false Bulgarian Empire. And because they're weak and there's lots of infighting and civil wars and stuff like that, they're invaded by a myriad of different neighbours, if you will. So you've got I'm going to pronounce these wrong, so get ready for it. The Magyars, never heard of them. The Pechenegs, there's a gun called a Pechenegue. and Rus. Do you know what the Rus are?
No.
Rus are early Russians, or the Rus. And with reignited conflict with the Byzantines, there's just basically lots of war going on.
Right.
They're not strong anymore, the Bulgarian Empire. So the Byzantines in 1018 conquered the land of the first Bulgarian kingdom and assimilated it into the imperial Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantines. And in 1018, the Bulgarian Empire was assimilated into the Byzantines and incorporated into the Eastern Roman Empire.
You know, what's funny is I always find it interesting that there wasn't any, like, texting back in the day, so you couldn't be like, hey, enemy, I'm a traitor, let me shoot you a quick text that our ruler is about to die so that you can, like, come and take over. But I feel like that's a common thread all over history, is right after one of the strongest ruler passes away, the strength of the empire quickly diminishes, and then they get taken over. And I don't know how they learn about that so quickly.
Yeah, so the Byzantines are the new Eastern Roman Empire. And Romans, whenever a Roman leader would change, they'd print new coins.
Mm.
And they'd put the coins into circulation. And the coins would have the head of the empire, or the emperor, sorry, on the coin. And that's how they knew, oh, there's a new king involved. I can hazard a guess. And back in those times, there's people that would live their lives to find out, oh, 7 years ago, my country was taken over by somebody else. I didn't even realize that. Do you know what I mean? Like, we think of history having full of war and stuff like that, but because news didn't spread quickly to the common folk.
Yeah, the farmers and stuff, I guess they're just going to go about their day. They don't really pay attention to who they're passing their eggs along to,
exactly,
more or less. But
so the Bulgarian people, as I said, they're under the control of the Byzantines. And they managed to form a rebellion, and they gained their freedom in 1185 and formed the Second Bulgarian Kingdom. Now, this is a big hurrah for Bulgaria, is your restructure. they were started off to be quite wealthy. They had good trade, they had decent politics, they had good policies, though it's a fresh kingdom, technically. So there's lots of infighting, lots of war, lots of rivalries, which just made them very weak.
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting internally and with their neighbours. So in 1396, the Ottoman Empire came in and took control of the entire land. Now, what I find rather interesting is, from my conclusion, if the Ottomans didn't come in and take Bulgaria, Bulgaria wouldn't exist today. Because of the infighting, what usually happens is the kingdom gets divided between people.
Right.
Which would mean the Second Bulgarian Empire would cease to exist. So you'd have, like, I don't know, five or six smaller countries, I guess, in that area. But the Ottomans came in and stopped the Bulgarian kingdom from dissolving, if you will. It just came under Ottoman control.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's quite interesting, that do you think of war and you think of conquered territory, destroying a civilization, but obviously I'm not a historian and stuff like that, but from my conclusion, this actually allowed the Bulgarian, this actually allowed the Bulgarian empire to not survive, but kind of go dormant for the next 500 years, while they're under the Ottoman control.
Yeah, and I mean, their empire ruled for so long, you can still see remnants of it in present day Sofia and Bulgaria, which I think is
Was quite interesting. In Sofia, you have a synagogue on one street, you've got a church 50 meters away, and then you've got a
mosque.
That's the word. Mosque the other 50 meters away.
And a McDonald's around the corner.
And a McDonald's, yeah, around the corner. Yeah. So at the end of the 19th century, the Ottomans started to become quite weak. And Russia, the Rus, stepped in and decided, you know what? We are also Orthodox Christians. We're going to help our Bulgarian friends. Also, little side note, the reason we're not getting into the Ottoman control of Bulgaria is because I would argue that Bulgaria is dormant and not a country, and it's now the Ottomans. And we're not talking about the Ottomans, we're talking about Bulgaria.
Sure.
So, the Russians stepped in and decided to have a little fight with the Ottomans, or the Turkish, which led to the Russo-Turkish War in 1877 to 1878. And this allowed Bulgaria to have their independence. After this, Bulgaria started taking lots of land and grew themselves in the Balkan states, but their neighbours obviously weren't happy with having such a big, powerful player. So this led to the Serbo-Bulgarian War in 1885. Bulgaria wins. So Bulgaria, in the case, just came out of Ottoman rule. They're quite strong. They've got their wits about them. And they want to show this off to the world. So they build something called the Alexander Nevsky Cathedral. And they build this in Sofia, which you can go to. And it's an absolutely beautiful place. We'll talk about that more later on.
Okay.
Now, what I find quite interesting is they built this cathedral, yes, to show their religious devotion to Christianity. But it was also a, hey, look at us. Don't mess with us. It was to show that they can build huge things. They can build amazing architecture. They are united under a common banner. It was used to show their military might. It was used to say, don't come knocking. We're going to knock you down. The first Balkan War occurred shortly after, 1912, 1913. And this was to get rid of the last remnants of the Ottomans in Europe, push them back into modern-day Turkey. So, it's going well for Bulgaria, but a few things, in my opinion, is this is their downfall. This is where they start to, the domino effect is happening.
Okay.
So, where you've got Bulgaria, Serbia, Greece, and Montenegro all teamed up against Ottoman to, like, really get them out of Europe. It ends up in a disagreement. Bulgaria did not get the land they were promised. You know, they decided, you know, we're going to divide the land.
Ah, they had a bad team. They didn't follow through.
Yeah, they had a bad team. But they still got land, but they didn't get as much as they were promised from the allies. Bulgaria decided to get a little bit too big for their boots and said, you know what, boys? We've been fighting with you for a year. Now I'm going to go to war with you. Okay? So this led to the Second Balkan War, which the Bulgarians lost badly. They lost the land that they conquered in the First Balkan War and some of their original land. This kept on, this was the tactic, if you will, Bulgaria approached for the next 100 years, joining the losing side. In World War I, they joined the Axis and they lost. And in World War II, they joined the Axis again and lost. Now, the interesting thing about Bulgaria during the World War II, now they were quite strongly linked to the Axis, Nazi Germany, and Nazi Germany was not happy at all that Bulgaria had so many Jews in their population. They said, you know what, get rid of them. And credit to Bulgaria, they refused. Bulgaria did not export or send away a single Jewish Bulgarian person in their population.
I will say, it's not that they refused, because you don't say no to someone so scary as you know who, but they had a really strong government official who kind of played the system a little bit.
Yeah, I kept on putting off, saying like stuff like, oh, we can't this month because there's a flood, or we can't do it next month because there's a
food, we need their labor.
Yeah, there's a food crisis. There's lots of reasons that, like you said, the Bulgarian government I wouldn't say defied, but like you said,
just delayed.
Until the end of World War II. So, very well done for Bulgaria with that. Now, although Bulgaria was linked to the Axis in World War II, they slowly started to come under the influence of communism. And communism took over Bulgaria, and obviously had these influences from the communistic state. And even to this day, there's a lot of communistic architecture, art, statues. It is kind of communisty blocky, but it's quite interesting at the same time, because it's modern history. And then in 1990, they became a democracy after the fall of the Soviet Union. And to this day, they're part of NATO, they're part of the EU. And they are gaining more and more ties to the West. So yeah, that's the history of Bulgaria. It's quite a fascinating history for such a, quote, small and unknown country. But there's a lot there. There's a lot of history if you're into it. I know I am, obviously, because I'm telling you all about it.
I think we forget, too, how powerful history can be. I can't remember what year we had a tour guide telling us that they only started letting the schools talk about the communism background in the country like a few years ago, because it's such a heated topic. There's some people who are so advocate for it and some people who are so against it and are ashamed of that part of their background. But I mean, just the knowledge of what happened is so powerful, and it's crazy to think they probably have only been learning about it in schools for like 20, 30 years.
Yeah. Well, that's what the tour guide was saying. He's got two grandfathers. One of them supported communism, one of them hated communism. And the one who supported communism would say the best thing happened was communism coming. And the one who didn't want communism said the worst thing that happened was communism coming. So it is quite divisive. And as you're saying, it's only relatively recently that the people are able to learn about it, because it is such a hot topic.
Yeah. So if you thought your family gatherings were fun, consider what that would be like.
Okay, so yes, that's Bulgaria. We've got the introduction all the way from the introduction of Slavic people up to the fall of communism in 20 minutes. Now, as always, lots of things to do in every country. We've done a few of these things. I'm going to recommend you to do some things, and hopefully I manage to entice your different hobbies and interests depending on what you're into. So, the first thing that I recommend you do, I don't care what your hobbies and interests are, you should 100%, 1,000,000% do this, If you're not into art, if you're not into nature or religion or culture or history or whatever, please do this because it is... Oh, it's a spiritual sanctuary in which you feel something special and sacred and timeless and formidable. It's really diverse. It's Rhea Monastery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, Rhea Monastery is south of Sofia, about an hour and a half drive, give or take. And whenever you come up to it, you think, oh, okay, it's just some stone walls. And I, to be honest, if you're driving past it, you could be kind of dismissive of it. But nope, park your car, get your butt out of the seat, and walk through the gates. And it's really weird because you go to the gates and it's just dull brick. And the gates, like the passageway is kind of encumbersome on you. Like it feels like you're narrowing. And then you open up to a courtyard and it's just filled with colour. In the background, you can see the snow-capped mountains. You can see evergreen trees surrounding the fortress. The monastery in the middle is just filled with intricate, vibrant frescoes depicting Bible stories. It's known as the Jerusalem of Bulgaria, and it's still active to this day. Built over a century ago, it's the anchor point of Orthodox Christianity in Bulgaria. It's revered as a national treasure and a very strong and sacred religious point for the Bulgarian people.
Yeah, I mean, it just has a beautiful story, too, of a guy just wanting to be closer to God, so he goes out into the wilderness to kind of worship, and I think that's really cool. But it's definitely a church that doesn't look like anything we've ever seen before. You know, you usually go into the churches and the inside are just beautiful and decorated and ornate, but the outside of this building is decorated in those scenes, like you said. And the surrounding courtyard, it almost looks like a Shakespeare theater to me, almost, where the monks, you know, live, and those are their rooms, and you can kind of just envision what a life would have been there a couple hundred years ago, where they...
Well, it was, like you said, you know, some bloke just wanted to get away from God, and wanted nice and quiet, and then what I find funny is everyone else thought, yeah, you know what, let's go do that together and make it not quiet, and they built the monastery. And then the fortress part came into play whenever they were under Ottoman rule. So, obviously, Ottoman is Arab, Christianity is bad. So they built the fortress and the monastery, and it was there. It was the fortress. So I find that, you know, if you look on the internet for images of Rhea, you can get a pretty similar to what you're going to experience. For me, Belogradchik, it had a lot more to it than the images you find on Google kind of portrayed. So yeah, we're going to look at Belogradchik rocks and fortresses. Now this is a further away location than Sofia. It's a 3.5 hour drive. But we stayed the night northwest of Sofia. It built by the Romans in 100 AD. The fortress kind of like incorporates natural formidable rock formations that has been developed over millions of years with erosion and stuff like that. And the rocks kind of like spiral up from the ground, and they're all very unique. And they all have names associated with them. So you have a rock that's called the Horse Rider, the Maiden, the Castle, Adam and Eve, Snake, the Elephant. And all of these here rocks have their own mythical cultural elements to them. The thing what I like about Belogradchik is you come into the fortress, huge open courtyard, and you see the formidable fortresses. And behind it, you see these beautiful rocks. And that's what you see on Google. But whenever you walk up the steps and you go into the actual old fortress, you are opened up with the Balkan mountains and the valley below, and for miles upon miles all you see is rolling hills and these beautiful impressive rock formations. And it's something that is, it seems like God took extra time to create this area.
We definitely didn't prepare for Bulgaria's countryside. I mean, the trees and the hills and the mountains and the lakes, it was beautiful. And what's cool about Belogradchik is they were in the top 10 or the top 20 of the, what is it called?
Oh, yes, the
the new world. Oh, the new wonders of the world.
That was it. Yeah, they got top.
It was one of the best new things you can see, and you can just envision there was a siege or something up there as well. So they had people in the fortress, like surviving off of the water from the wells, and it's just a different step into history.
Well, that's it. I mean, you go into it, you go to the old fortress built by the Romans, you step into it, and you're in the new fortress, which is built by the Ottomans. And then there was, like you said, the siege between Serbia and Bulgaria, and we actually managed to go on a... We were quite lucky. When we went, it was the annual celebration of this siege. And to make it not sound so gruesome, basically, the sieges were Bulgarian, and they were captured, and the leader was beheaded, and the head fell down a hill. And there's a monument where the head was. and it is quite cool. Now, it's a nice little town as well, Belogradchik. You can see out over the valleys. We stayed in a little nice B&B. And we were also quite lucky in the sense there was a big storm that came in that night. And I liked it. It was really good, Belogradchik.
Yeah, on the spooky side, I was reading stories around. They've seen apparitions of, like, Ottoman soldiers on horses.
Ooh.
And there's supposed to be some kind of mystical energy about the Belogradchik rocks. You can listen to the audio tour while you're there. Get the audio guide and they'll tell you about the mystical energy. And I don't know if we felt it, but let me tell you, waking up to a lightning storm at 3 a.m. will definitely make you think there's something a little spooky about the area.
Yeah, especially with the annual celebration of this event. And it was really cool. It was really cool. Speaking of audio tours, we wish there was an audio tour for the next thing I suggest. Now, I'm suggesting this, but also not suggesting this. The next thing we're going to suggest and not suggest is called Muguru Cave, northwest of Belogradchik, about 30 to 40 minutes. And it's an old cave system. And for me personally, I'm not too interested in caves. But what really stuck out to me was there's cave paintings in here. Unfortunately, whenever we went, those were closed. However, that makes sense. I don't know how you can close cave paintings. But there's no audio guide, and it's not in English. So try and do your research if you want to see some cave paintings. It lasts for about an hour.
Call ahead.
Yeah, call ahead and find out. So if you're not into those, got some more awesome things. So there's Devataki Cave, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, and it's known as the Eyes of God. And it's a cave system, not that big. I wouldn't really call it a cave system. It's more of you're walking and there's like big rocks on top of you. Like, it's a really, really big cave. And if you Google Eye of God, you should probably see it. And you look up and you see the night sky. These are two huge holes cut out of the limestone rock. You've also got Prohododna Cave, which is kind of the same idea. Lots of their own ecological environment inside these cave systems. If you want to find out about really, really old Bulgaria land, you go to the Thracian tombs, where you see lots of Thracian kings and stuff like that. If you're going for a natural side of things, you want to go to the waterfalls, you can go to Krasuna Waterfalls, nice and tranquil there. Or if you want to go in your hiking shoes, you can hike the seven Rhea lakes near Rhea Monastery. Obviously, you can do those in a day or a few hours, but it is highly suggested you take a few days to do it. Bring your camping gear and just chill out. And then finally, if you want to go for the east side of Bulgaria, you can go to the second capital, if you will, Plovdiv. Now, Plovdiv has a Roman theatre, which is still used to this day. You can literally walk down the steps and sit where someone in Roman times would have sat and watched a play or a gladiatorial fight or whatever. And I think that's quite phenomenal. So that is Bulgaria. That's a few things you could do. As always, there's bountiful things you can do. I hope you've learned something new, and I hope that you are a little bit more intrigued in going to Bulgaria.
The one thing you didn't mention that I think is worth bringing up too, that they can do, because it's right in the middle of Sofia and it's right next to the Alexander Cathedral. It is St. Sophia's Church.
Yes, how did I not Oh, yes, yes. You hit me. What have you got for us, actually? Let's go casty. Give us a little bit of...
Put the shoe on my other foot. It is not the most impressive building, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
So it's not the most impressive looking building on the outside. It's just like this brick building. But that's because it was built in like the 4th century. It is one of the oldest churches in Sofia. And what I think is really interesting about it that we learned is you can actually go underneath the church. And underneath the church is the foundations of the other churches. So they built it kind of on the outside of the city as part of like a graveyard.
Oh, yeah.
And then I don't remember what happened from there, but I remember the Ottomans came and turned the church into a mosque during the Ottoman Empire. But then there was like an earthquake or something and the big...
Yeah.
What are the structures that go on the mosques?
Oh, yes. The big towers. I don't know what they're called, but the towers...
They fell down in the earthquake, and so that was like a bad omen for them, and they abandoned the church. So the church was then used as like a place for artillery, and somehow became a church later on. But in the foundations, you can see the different levels of the churches, and they have really ancient tombs as well that you can kind of walk around. And it's a really kind of spooky atmosphere. And I had a fun story I was going to tell you about the church, too, which is why I was, like, waiting for you to do it so I could chime in, but I'll just go ahead. So in 1721, there was a Venetian scout that dressed as a Turkish merchant to visit the church, and apparently there was, like, a staircase, because at the time it was the mosque.
Yeah.
He went down to, like, the dungeon area and entered a room that had Christian parchment and, like, ordinary books. They were hoping that they would find some like gold at the bottom of the church, but they didn't find anything. And when they came back up, they fell sick and passed away. And so they bricked up the entrance to the dungeon. And historians believe that the old books were infected with like a fatal fungus.
Mm-hmm.
So that like the manuscripts and old books after that point, after like the 1700s, when they would be given to museums and libraries, they would first be placed in a gas chamber where toxic gas would be released to kill all...
That's mad.
Like, fungi. It's just so crazy. And then apparently there's also, like, some apparitions of a young woman in a white dress with a cross on her church. So she would apparently also appear when it was a mosque and go by the Turks. And so that was also something that...
Yeah, they're spooky about it.
That spooked them, but...
Yeah, because of, you know, like we went over, without going over it again, because there's so many civilizations, people just built on top of each other. They wouldn't knock things down, they just reuse it because it's expensive to build these amazing buildings. But yeah, thank you very much for listening to my rambles about the history of Bulgaria, some things you can do, covering the settlement of Slavic people up to the adoption of democracy and the fall of communism in Bulgaria. We've looked at some interesting things you can do, from religious sites to natural hikes, and a little bonus, a spooky story on the Church of St. Sophia. It's just beside Alexander Nevsky's church, cathedral, so you could probably do both. But now, Cassidy is going to ordain ourselves with a spooky dooky story about...
Oh, I am following your theme. So I'm falling into the nature theme.
Oh, a spooky story regarding nature.
Yeah, so we're going into the Bulgarian wilderness this week, and I kind of put together two stories for you because they kind of go a bit hand in hand, I find. But like we talked about, this language is difficult. I'm going to pronounce so many things wrong. I apologize in advance. I'm going to sound them out, but let me tell you.
I think we can all assume that it's fair game. We're going to pronounce some of these wrong.
So the first story in the Bulgarian wilderness is the Galiamo Gradchik.
Okay, so we're one sentence in and we've already pronounced something wrong.
Thousands of Bulgarians believe there's a supernatural secret underneath the pool in this area. And funny enough, it goes back not to Bulgarian history, but it relates back to Egyptian times.
Okay.
So another civilization for you. Most popular theories are that there's the tomb of the Egyptian goddess Bastet, the half-cat, half-woman, that there's a gold treasure trove and or a sarcophagus over here containing the history of the world 2,000 years ago and a prediction for the next 2,000 years.
Okay.
So it's supposed to be a very mystical area. People will spend the night there. They'll try and find what's behind the strange energy, and there's a lot of reports around supernatural phenomenon. But the most notable one came about in the 1990s, and that is because Ludmila, who was the daughter of the Minister of Culture at the communist time, put together an expedition to try and identify what was behind this energy with the help of some archaeologists and associates. She put together an expedition and they headed to an area that was a bit dangerous at the time. So at the time, this border area was with an area of Turkey and it was a strictly guarded area that had shoot to kill instructions. So it was a very dangerous area. Before anything could be uncovered from the expedition, two things happened. So the first one was that Ludmila actually passed away and she was quickly followed by the Minister of Mineral Resources, who was also on the expedition. His name was Stamen Staminov. And so with two people from the expedition passing away, they were like, okay, we're out. This is a little weird. And they packed up and left. But before they left the area, they sent some dynamite and like blew up their dig site.
So no one else can kind of like come back to it and, you know, suffer the same issues that they're suffering.
Yes. They kept the expedition a secret, but then when communism collapsed in 1989, two of the participants published some books about it, and then the new media took over and spread the news, and you know how media does. They embellished some details, and it kind of became this big phenomenon. Mysterious lore about locations are not unique to Bulgaria. As you know, you're a UK guy, so you know you have Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Over in England, the United States has Area 51. But what I think makes the difference here with this first story about Galliamo is that it wasn't like made by some fringe group. It was high-ranking members of the Communist Party. So the Communist Party collapsed in 89. And so in the autumn of 1990, the country's a bit in disarray. It's trying to transition out of communism. There's not really any like open market democracy plan about how to get that up and running. So it's a bit chaotic at the time. So it's in this atmosphere that a group go to Sarachina to hopefully find some gold treasure. It's a mix of people from the Bulgarian army and they take with them some psychics. And so Sarachina is like this village near Sofia.
Okay, so they're on the hunt for gold.
We're on a hunt for gold. On December 6th of 1990, the military move into the region and begin to do some excavations. And with any kind of secret military adventure, of course, we need a code name. So what do you think this code name operation is?
Ooh.
Any guesses?
People at home. I'm going to guess Operation Gold.
It is called Operation Light Beam.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Some sources call it Operation Shining Ray or Sunbeam, but I'll just call it Operation Light Beam because I like that. Whatever's going on is super secret. There's armed men turning away natural curiosity seekers coming to see what the dig is about. Trespassers were dealt with harshly, and the whole place just is crawling with military. The rumor at the time was that they were looking for some ancient treasure, reportedly the hidden treasure of King Samuel, but stories would leak that they actually found something a little more bizarre.
Okay.
According to some information leaked from Colonel Svetko Kanav, the group dug into a strange spiral tunnel and found a mysterious slab of unknown material that was never identified. Soon after, a psychic woman named Elisvita Loganov was brought into the excavation site. She was known to have the gift of foresight and could apparently tell what was under this mysterious metal without any instruments. So she said that the stone was a biological protection slab covered in dangerous bacteria that should not be disturbed. They brought in another psychic called Baba Vagna. who claimed that there was a skeleton down in the hole that was neither man nor woman, and they claimed that there was something sending them messages through telepathy.
Oof, so it's getting quite...
We're going straight into the spooky strangeness.
Yeah, the realm of obscurity.
But of course, the military are the military and continue through the tunnel trying to excavate the object despite these concerns and warnings. The military being the military went into the tunnel and tried to excavate anyway and found some anomalies such as a slab in the form of a concave lens, an image on a stone of a tall humanoid figure which was taller than the normal human, and another tunnel with smooth walls and a slivery floor. Yeah. They try to approach the slab, but apparently were repelled by a bright beam of light and an invisible force field that kept them from getting too close. The psychics, of course, LOL told you so. And warned that the cave was protected, that whatever was down there was not ready to be discovered by humans and would defend itself with violent force if necessary.
Okay.
A third psychic, also known as a clairvoyant, her name was Gina Demrova, would warn, saying, "When excavations were held in Saracina, the aliens told me the research must stop. Do not dig. It is not your time. There's the center of the earth, a depth of 2,000 kilometers, and a finding that is like crystals. It is as big as the sun when it rises. Don't touch it. People will not reach it, but they will disturb the atmosphere. It is a big crystal, which is dangerous, and it will stay there as long as the earth. It controls its movement. Stop digging because the earth will perish, and hard days will come for your people. There will be many new terrible diseases if you dig in Saracina. In the hole, there is the underworld, but this is not hell. There will live people like you down there, but their origin is different. There is a space device found there. It is sent from an extraterrestrial civilization with cosmonauts down there. Thousands of years ago, when your country did not exist, a civilization from another planet sent a spaceship with three astronauts to Earth. They were not humans, but robots, and were sent to explore life on Earth. They suffered damage, and their spaceship crashed in Saracina. With every meter of digging down there, higher and higher radiation will be emitted. Do not dig into the Saracina hole because it is not your time now."
So that's a very elaborate...
Very specific message.
From a psychic or a... What do you call them?
Yeah. Clairvoyant.
Clairvoyance. Yeah. So let me just summarize this very quickly so I'm on the same page. Comedy's involved... The army thinks there's gold over here. It goes over to an area... tunnel?
Yeah, like a cave almost, and start digging.
Starts digging for this hidden gold. All of a sudden, they are hit by a beam of light and an invisible force field, not allowing them to get to this tablet. And they've got this clairvoyant saying, "Yo, don't. Not your time yet, bro."
Yeah, more or less, you're up to speed.
Okay.
But of course, they continue to dig, and the excavation continues, bringing about some strangeness from the countryside. So locals apparently were seeing UFOs in the area, ghostly apparitions. Some of them even claimed that they had gotten thoughts beamed into their heads that were not their own. But the excavation continued for 2 years, and apparently the remote seer Lognova would claim to be in constant connection with the entity from the tunnel and channeled messages through her. She would transcribe over 1,000 pages of messages and apparently would like get them in code, and then she would have to decipher them.
Okay. That is quite interesting, because I mean, that is quite difficult to do, to formulate your own code system, and then write messages in code and then pretend to unencrypt them. That's quite a difficult task to do.
Mm-hmm. In an interview, she said that the codes are like ciphered letters, and she's gotten more than 1,000 pages, like I said, all received during the excavations. The texts were about ancient writings who would tell the story of human creation, how it was created, how it was brought to Earth, how it must survive, and what we must do to keep Earth alive. Apparently, Earth is part of a common planetary synchronicity, and the cosmic collectorium wanted Earth to survive, and it must not be broken because chaos would, of course, ensue. They would talk about the so-called energy humans that were marked by them, and that the energy humans had to be, you know, continuously going for Earth to survive. Yeah. That was the message that she kind of got from that. Apparently, some of the other psychics were also given a lot of messages, but with this kind of information, it's pretty overwhelming. It can be kind of chaotic.
Yeah.
So a lot of them would quit. Another one did pass away during the dig. But the government, I mean, it's crazy. They continued to dig for 2 years and they didn't terminate the excavation until November of 1992. And I don't know if that's because the government finally kind of settled in a sense that the Communist Party was gone. They kind of got their footing now in democracy. And so they're like, why are we putting all this money into this excavation kind of thing? Yeah. Or if it just kind of naturally came to a really spooky time and they're like, this is a lot of weird, strange phenomena. Let's just continue to take the hint and maybe get out of here. It doesn't really say, but that it ended in November of 1992.
With no gold.
With no gold. Empty-handed. At that point, the hole was 70 meters deep and led to a 160-meter tunnel with nothing found. So the military packed up the operation, sealed the hole with concrete, and left, indeed leaving no official reason why they were there in the first place. All the evidence was collected for anything. And then one of the psychics said that all of her notebooks mysteriously vanished, along with all the journals that was composed in Saracina. All the film that they shot with the project just disappeared, and she doesn't have any evidence left to certify her work besides her own words.
Oh, so that's a coincidence. But at the same time, if it did happen, I understand why the people would have taken away all the
yeah
resources.
3 years later, one of the leading officers in Operation Lightbeam committed suicide, but we don't know whether or not it's related to the events, of course. But over the years, the excavation had led to lots of rumors, lots of crazy tales. Depending on the story, people talk about the military finding an interdimensional portal, alien skeletons, giant power crystals, plans for alien technology, the secrets to Atlantis, which always seems to pop up.
Yeah, everywhere. Yeah.
And every kind of conspiracy theory. But hey, it wouldn't be a story if we didn't throw it in there.
That's a very, that's a story of the ages.
So yeah, with the stories happening to be with like a triangular spaceship, it led to the area being called Area 51 of Bulgaria. And of course, it became a very well-known mystery throughout the country without too much to show for it. When locals are asked about it, they show an area of low shrubs besides a power substation, though both believers and skeptics think that the excavations were very unique between Guglielmo and Saracina because they show Bulgaria's special status as an energy vortex, as a chosen country only temporarily beset by problems and bad luck, but that would eventually shine again for the world to marvel at. For the skeptics, the digs illustrate the Bulgarian modus operandi of searching for supernatural help or maybe real or imaginary greatness in the past as a way of dealing with the crazy economic circumstances of the 1990s. Yeah, that is the mysteries of the Bulgarian wilderness.
Wow, okay, so that's a lot to take in. You've got some spooky UFOs, hidden areas, the hunt for treasure. Everything's mysteriously vanished.
Vanishing, yeah, evidence.
Yeah, so that's Bulgaria in a very small slither of what it has to offer. We hope you enjoyed the travel. We hope you've enjoyed the Chance of Murder. Because that's what you get on Travel with a Chance of Murder. You get both. Or Travel with a Chance of Murder - UFO Stories. that's us.
We'll be in Asia Pacific next week, and we hope that you'll join us at our next destination around the globe.
On behalf of the flight crew, thank you for flying with us, and have a pleasant day.